Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Naturalist Capitalist. Before we get going, I'm just going to advertise my friend Will Bell's Blueberry Wine. Go check it out on Rabbit Eye Wine on the internet. It's great stuff. Tonight, on the other end, I've got an editor from the Mises Institute. He's a Florida man, and he's a great quote tweet battler on Twitter. Oh, Bishop, how you doing tonight, man?
Doing great, man. Glad to join you.
Yeah, you're somebody that I've actually come to like more the more I've argued with you. I don't think that has happened on Twitter too often, but what I like about you is you're never subtweeting anyone. You always quote tweet everybody, or you tag them, or you go right at them in the comments, and I really respect that. And you also, you're kind of snarky and you're kind of jabby, but you're not ridiculous. Like, you're kind of there to really battle out the difference of opinion, and I really like that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I was raised on the AOL chat rooms of old, so kind of a little bit of that to my style a little bit. But I think that these conversations that are, you know, worth having should be done directly and bluntly. And so very rarely am I trying to go after some people personally. Sometimes that's the case. Very, very rarely I try. It's a vice of mine. But for the most part, I'm trying to offer, you know, value-free analysis to a certain extent. And I'll have some fun with it a little bit, but I'm very rarely trying to go after the person. I'm usually trying to go after whatever the idea is. And there's some ideas that I think are very wrong. And I try to do my best way to kind of, illustrate that. And I've enjoyed going back and forth with you. And again, I much prefer having honest debate and discussion than, you know, being petty and subtweeting things, all this passive aggressiveness bullshit that's out there.
Yeah, the other thing is, and we talked about this in the DMs a little bit, there's a lot of cheerleading, like just people kind of flocking to whoever is saying something that they like. There's a lot of retweeting and a lot of agreeing with other people. It's really valuable to have those kind of in-depth, heated disagreements and actually battle those ideas out. That's also lacking on Twitter a lot, I think.
Yeah. And the good thing is I think that, you know, it's better. I think Twitter as a whole is pretty good for having serious conversations out there, in the grand scheme of things. But there's definitely an element where there's certain people that they take weight. They have too much of their ego invested in being liked. You know, it's like the Norm Macdonald quip about comedians that prefer applause rather than laughter. And I think that there's some people out there in the movement kind of like that. And I just don't have much time for it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. So before we get into the discussion, I don't know much about your long-term history. Were you kind of a traditional right-winger and you found out about Mises and Rothbard? Or how did you end up there? What got you into this whole thing?
Yeah, well, I was definitely born in a Republican family. My dad was communications director for the RNC. My mom was, you know, the first female field man for the RNC back in the day in Florida. But I kind of got out of that phase at the end of high school. You know, I was, the Iraq war was just indefensible. I started engaging with people, you know, that actually held ideas rather than simply listen to, you know, Sean Hannity. And then, you know, kind of that Ron Paul, you know, movement 08 was the great awakening to a whole new way of thinking. And so from then on, you know, I was reading my Rand, I was reading my Rothbard. I really loved Brian Doherty's book, Radicals for Capitalism, and the whole kind of history of the libertarian movement. And it's funny, there's some people that kind of think he portrays Rothbard kind of negatively in that book. But like, that's the book that made me fall in love with Rothbard. Like, I loved the little infighting and kind of where his stands were on that sort of stuff. And so, you know, I've been kind of an Austro-libertarian, you know, since 08, 09. And then after when the Tea Party took over, in 2010, I had the opportunity of going to DC, and I wasn't really interested in like Republican Party politics at that point, but Ron Paul was the man, obviously. And so I was just excited to be up there and be in a committee that Ron Paul was on. And so I was kind of the Austrian mole there. And so like my friends were just, you know, Ron Paul's office. And so, you know, it was a lot of fun having that sort of backdoor perspective of being kind of an Austrian mole and kind of a more normal, normie Republican office. And then shortly after that, ran for office, which ended up turning pretty all right, because when I lost, I ended up getting a job at the Mises Institute with Jeff Deist, and it's the best organization in the world. So it's been a pretty good ride.
So when did your friction with the existence of the Libertarian Party first start? Was that the Mises Caucus, or have you kind of always felt that way, or when did that kind of start happening?
Honestly, I was like 2016. I was actually pretty optimistic about the LP as kind of the next jumping board, and it was because I thought Trump was going to lose, and I thought here was going to be a moment where, you know, Trump was going to lose to Hillary. The GOP was going to purge his ranks from the party. They were going to blame him for everything. And then I thought, okay, well, here's an interesting opportunity where, you know, I've always been more comfortable as with that libertarian label. And here's the opportunity for someone kind of in that Tom Woods fashion to reach out from the party and bring in this disaffected base and now seize the GOP as controlled ops and all the labels out there. And then Trump won. And the, you know, when I have this conversation about the GOP versus the LP, everyone gets fixated on everything Trump did wrong. And it's fine. Yeah, you know, look at my articles on The Wire during the Trump years. Like, I mean, I was critical of Trump far more than I was ever praising him. But what happened is that it's not about Trump. It's about the people that supported Trump. And so it was during that time where, you know, I started recognizing that, you know, who was a Rick Santorum supporter in 2012 was now wanting to get rid of the FBI. And I started seeing this radicalizing nature play out, you know, here in Bay County where I'm from, talking to other Republicans out there. And that's when I kind of got, you know, I recognized, okay, there's something here that wasn't true back in the 2010s, 2000s. And then really it's, I think that it was really after 2020 where I truly became tired of this sort of narrative that both sides are wrong. And it's because, you know, Team Red winning made me one of the freest people in the world. And I think that there was, you know, I don't think it does libertarians any good to delude themselves about how the political system actually operates, how the party system actually operates. And I what I try to keep emphasizing is that what I think people like about the Libertarian Party Mises Caucus, having a group of good people led by great communicators, motivated by the right ideas, that is a great thing. What Michael Heiss has accomplished is something that he should be tremendously proud of. He has built a very ideologically driven pack, you know, and perhaps with the best ideologically driven pack on the idea side ever. But that does not necessitate embracing a third party structure in a two party government. And I think that if the way that you use to defend that position is lying to yourself about the two major parties, lying about how the legal system works, or lying about the prospects of success, I don't think that is good for anything. Now, if you are if your top priority is not the ideas of the Mises Caucus becoming politically relevant, but rather making the LP great again or great for the first time, whatever it is, then that's fine. I don't know why I don't personally value that, but whatever value is subjective. That is different than what I think a lot of people think the Mises Caucus is. And so I just try to keep, you know, I think there's value in emphasizing where I see disconnects in the logic. Now, obviously, I have an incentive here. I'm trying to get as many good right-wing libertarians to join my cause because I think that's the best way to move this populist right moment to a more libertarian direction. But more than that, I don't care if you just decide to get out of politics entirely. I don't care if you want to get involved in your local Democratic Party. Hell, I don't even care if you want to go into the Green Party route. I can make a case for the Green Party easier than I can for the LP in certain states. I just want to try to kind of emphasize here is where I see the failures in this logic here. And that's where that's where some of that tension I get on Twitter at times plays out.
Sure. So I supported Rand Paul in 2016. And then I supported Tulsi Gabbard in 2020. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up voting Libertarian both times in the general election because I just wasn't satisfied enough with Trump or Hillary or Biden. And I, like, in general, I feel like that's the way it should be. Like, I agree with you that if there's a chance in one of the major parties to get somebody good, that's where the struggle and the effort should be placed. I mean, because if you get Rand Paul as the Republican nominee, that's worth so much more than Dave Smith as the Libertarian nominee. I'd completely agree with you on that. What do you do, though, You know, maybe Trump was, I don't even know who you voted for. I'm assuming you voted for Trump. But if someone, like, let's say Marco Rubio is the Republican nominee, do you think that if there's somebody that's just absolutely horrible on both sides, that a spoiler can actually send a message to the people? Because what was so disappointing about 2016 and sort of the same with 2020 was there was just nobody good anywhere. You know, like the Democrat sucked, the Republican sucked, and the Libertarian was just kind of, I mean, I think Jo Jorgensen was better than Gary Johnson, but she was just super boring. And there was all the leftist pandering stuff that went on too. So it was just a total flop. And then Gary Johnson, I thought the same thing. So if you could have somebody who's really good as the Libertarian nominee fail at getting somebody good in either of the other parties, and this goes for any race, like if you're running for governor, Senate, or anywhere, you know, around the country, do you think there's any utility to the middle finger in the general election, or do you think it's just completely useless?
I think it's a very rare moment where that matters, but that's fine. I'm not saying that, you know, I voted against Republicans, you know, and that's fine. What I think is less, but what I think is the more interesting question though, is how do we improve the quality of the candidates coming out of the GOP? You know, how do you get someone who is not a Marco Rubio being the leader of the Republican Party, and being that nominee? And the thing is that requires, you know, the work that goes into that, you know, the real politics is not going out there and casting a vote November every once, you know, every 4 years or 2 years. Like that's the lowest form of political action. You know, that almost doesn't even matter at that point. Like, what matters is the buildup to it. It is the participation within the primary process. It's the organizational structure that gives your ability to amplify the influence that you can have in those primary matchups. It's building a bench of candidates at the local level, the school board level, at the state level, that can, you know, become those the next Thomas Massey, that can become, you know, the Matt Gaetz out there, right? It's building that bench. And so, sure, if there's a terrible Republican nominee out there, and you really think, like, for example, I voted against, I wrote in Ron Paul in 2008 and in 2012. I did so because I could not figure out personally what was a better outcome, Obama or McCain or Romney. And I've got no apologies for that. I voted for Trump because I didn't think Hillary and Trump were comparable. One was a war criminal and one had yet to been able to prove he was a war criminal, right? That was a very binary choice for me. And then when 2020 came around, it's just, you know, that was kind of peak COVID. Is that I think that while obviously plenty of things that Trump did wrong, you know, he was still relative to the rest of the world. And that's something that I've really kind of gotten a perspective of at the Institute more, dealing with, you know, scholars from other countries. You know, we as libertarians, we get so fixated on all the flaws with America's government, and we should never stop highlighting the evils of the American regime. Like that's important, but it's also important to have a little bit of scale of you know, relative to every other world government out there. And I think particularly in the case of COVID, Trump relative to just about everyone besides, you know, maybe Bolsonaro and a few other places, you know, was kind of rare, and just given the ability for someone like Ron DeSantis to have so much depiction. So I saw that as kind of a vote against what's kind of played out with Biden. But again, so that's why I wasn't indifferent between those two. If I was indifferent between those two, then a protest vote is perfectly fine. But again, to me, what the LP Mises Caucus sort of stuff is, it's not simply voting libertarian. It is political action. That's that boring stuff, you know, sitting in the meetings and taking time out of your day to do that organizational stuff that, you know, as we've seen, can often lead to some all sorts of petty bickering and things like that. That's that sort of effort and the money that goes into it. Again, I appreciate the sacrifice that goes into that sort of stuff. I just feel like that is a complete waste investing it into the party structure of the LP, and will always be a waste investing it in the party structure of the LP rather than, you know, having an occasional vote here and there, you know, as a middle finger against some awful Republican running against a commie Democrat.
So why is it inevitably a failure? Why is that not just short term? Why do you think it never could become something?
Because America has a two-party system. It is codified in our structures of government. Now, you can complain about that and say that's unjust, fine, but, you know, justice, right? It is what it is. And so what that means is the Libertarian Party is necessarily a party about voter party reform. It is not a party about liberty by its nature. Liberty is the excuse it uses to justify party reform. And so the beating the duopoly will always be the number one priority of the LP. And I don't think the duopoly is the number one problem in America. I think the number one problem in America is our warfare state financed by the Federal Reserve in an undemocratic, you know, deep state federal regime that's hostile to your average American and completely, you know, beyond the rims of any sort of accountability. I think that's the problem. I don't think the two-party structure is the problem. And I think historically, that we've seen changes within political parties that are massive ideological revolutions. What we want is a revolution within the form. And we want the form to be in one of the two major political parties. And I think the GOP is brewing for that when you have, you know, 70% of Trump voters that know in their hearts the election was stolen and that the presidency we currently have is illegitimate. They see themselves as enemies of the state. And to me, that's the people I want to win over. I don't think there's any sort of serious threat against the regime that doesn't factor in the Trump-based coalition. And so if we simply are willing to take on the label that the Trump people like, and we speak to them as fellow travelers, as neighbors, as friends, and ask them to follow us because we have ideas that can give them the ends they want, make America great again, we can make America great again. I think that is something that can work within the current political system. I think trying to build up a third party, if you're going to build a third party, then what you need to do is you need to try to kill one of the two existing parties, right? So if the LP wanted to get serious about outflanking the right from the right and commit itself to being a right-wing party, and that was going to be its core, for one, I don't think the L word in the title helps. Yeah, I think there'd have been better chance, for example, about the Patriot Party idea that Trump supporters were thinking about when they got really pissed at the GOP, right? Mm-hmm. That would be, I think the Constitution Party, the Constitution Party Mises Caucus, what would be a more interesting project than the LP, because by its nature, we as libertarians, we need to build coalitions. And so if the one, you know, if your label is the LP, there's not a label that is less useful for attracting non-libertarians to join libertarians than putting your branding right on it, right? You want something kind of, you know, vague and boomerish to get the people that we need to join us. And so that's where I think the difference is that it's structurally within this system works against this third party. And again, there's too much emphasis on, it would require too much emphasis on changing that over, you know, trying to get a state to secede or something really fun, which would be simply, it'd be similarly the sort of task ahead.
Yeah, I think I agree with you a little bit. There's a little bit too much emphasis on the party structure instead of trying to actually in your community or change things in your state or whatever. And I think that, you know, a lot of the Praxians, what they've been criticizing libertarians for is also accurate, you know, that you actually made a tweet about this yesterday because you were on Kyle's show and you said the thing I like, or maybe you said it today, I can't remember, but you said the thing I like about Kyle is the least interesting thing about him is that he's a libertarian. Mm-hmm. And that's something everyone in the movement should strive for. I agree with that because a lot of, you're also seeing that with the Mises Caucus takeover. A lot of the people in the party, it's their dynasty. It's the only thing they've ever been in control of or had any success in because it's a bunch of losers. And then once anyone comes in to challenge their ridiculously low amount of power that they have, they freak out. So I agree with you there. But I think, you know, last year, like I've almost had the opposite reaction to 2020 that you did. Like I hate the Republicans after 2020. And I don't mean the voters. I mean like the people who were in office. Like I feel like they just colossally failed, with the CARES Act. Thomas Massie was the only one who really put up any sort of resistance to it. And then when the 2020 relief bill came through, there were only like six Republicans in the Senate who voted against it. And when Democrats vote for that type of shit, I don't know. Like, I don't hold it against them the same way because they already admittedly suck. Like, they don't pretend to be good on any of that type of stuff. When Republicans support that, it really makes my blood boil because I used to be a Republican. I come from a right-wing household. And also it's just what they say they're better at. Yeah. So it like, it just completely pissed me off. And as a libertarian, I feel like I've been able to reach people that I wouldn't be able to as a Republican. Like I've got a pretty non, as far as the right and left structure goes, the audience I have is mostly Trump supporters, but I've also reached a lot of people on the left because they just see the things I'm talking about. So do you think there's any, you know, like I think that what you're doing is better in the Republican Party. Like you're probably a better Republican than you would be a libertarian, capital L libertarian. But do you think like someone like Scott Horton, I think he's going to be way more effective as, you know, the position that he has, like a libertarian who's not really feeding into the culture war. Like that is some people's battle. But for him, I think he's way better off where he is. So do you think that they're, you know, maybe the it's not the same channel for everybody to take? Do you think there's variance there? Or?
Yeah, I'm not a political universalist in any degree. And I mean, I was also pissed off at the Republicans too. And your average Republican voter is pissed off at them too.
Right.
And so that's the beauty of it is that, you know, what we have right now is you have a lot of Republicans trying to go after the scalps. Unfortunately, not of everyone that has fingerprints on every reckless spending bill. But, you know, Liz Cheney is going to be kicked out of office because Republicans turned against her.
Right.
And so those are the biggest threat to neocons are Republicans being active in primaries. To the other point, though, is that, again, I don't think everyone should be a Republican. I don't think Scott Horton should be a Republican. I think that Scott Horton needs to be Scott Horton.
Right.
What I don't think Scott Horton needs, though, is the LP. Right. Scott Horton has his platforms that he's done a great job building. I mean, he's an encyclopedia of foreign policy information. What makes Scott Horton great is not the LP. I think Scott Horton's better than the LP. He doesn't need that party perspective. He can just be Scott Horton independent. And he's still doing Scott Horton things and can reach across the aisle and do whatever he needs to do there. You know, Dave Smith is better than the LP, right? He doesn't need the LP to go on Joe Rogan's show. Like he's doing that. I don't think what you're doing, you don't need the party behind you to do what you're doing. And so that's my whole thing is that you don't need to take over this to spend resources taking over this castle because this castle isn't value to the people that you're just talking about. The party's only, those castles are only valuable if you're trying to make this party worth something. And then again, those accomplishments transcend that. I will say though, is I do think, for example, in Scott Horton's case, now I think the best thing that could possibly happen with Scott Horton would be to have someone in the Pentagon or a decision, you know, making position, State Department, whatever, be a Scott Horton fan. Like I, if you got, you know, one or two people in a decision-making thing, I'm not saying Secretary of Defense or whatever, but like that would be the ultimate payoff. And that is not going to come from outside of the party structure. That's going to be, you know, I think the way that things are going right now, the best hope would be, you know, some sort of Tucker Carlson style Republican stumbling upon fool's errand, right? And reading that. And so that's where I think one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about trying to push sort of my Republican thing is that not that it's for everyone, but I think that when we're thinking about this just broader goal of spreading the Liberty Movement or whatever, you know that aspect that is kind of key to the LP Mises Caucus kind of strategy there, we don't need to create a nation full of libertarians. That would be great. You know, there's organizations dedicated to education for that purpose, the Mises Institute, one of those, right? But you don't need a party to kind of convert libertarians. What we need to do is to create more influential libertarians. 3,000 influential libertarians is better than 3 million libertarian voters, or and to me, like, so the question is how do you build, how do you make influential people within this sort of political world? And again, I think that's done by building your capital up through successful political campaigns within one of these major parties. Obviously right now, I think one has a value over the other because I've seen that happen. I've got a buddy in Mike Lee's office. They used to work in Mike Lee's office that was able to influence policy. I mean, Mike Lee's been one of the really strong people against various military adventures overseas. He had his legislative director every day at work. The first three websites he read was Mises, Lou Rockwell, and antiwar.com. And so that's one person taking now Scott Horton, has his own position to now put it into practice. And that I think is what we need more of.
I plan to vote for Mike Lee if he runs for Senate next year. So, I mean,
much better than Egg McMullen or.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people think that I am like a 100% strict libertarian voter, and that's not true. I mean, I voted for Tulsi. I voted for Sununu when I was in New Hampshire. I probably would have voted for him again last year because the libertarian guy, with Daryl Perry, he's a fucking joke, probably wouldn't have voted for him. So, yeah, I mean, I think that being smart matters. Like, I really don't. I mean, I kind of agree with Dave when he says the Libertarian Party is a, and I know you don't agree with this, but it's just a vessel or it's just a vehicle.
It is a vehicle. The problem is just it's a vehicle that doesn't work, right? But it very much is. Like, you know, and I recognize they're trying to use it like that. But
yeah, so I want to shift gears a little bit. I am actually glad that Joe Biden is president, and it's not because I think he's good. It's actually because I think he's worse than Trump. But the left has mostly gone insane. I mean, because last year the right was kind of unreachable because they were just all about we just got to win again or we're going to have communism, and they're just ignoring everything that was already happening. So I was trying to talk to the left and I had some success, but most of it just it was futile. And you know, now they're just absolutely insane. But I feel like the right has actually gotten a lot better now that they've had all these losses. You know, now that after Trump getting impeached twice, I think that was really good for the right. It kind of opened their eyes to who the enemy is. I think now they suddenly care about spending. They suddenly care about civil liberties. It's almost like a switch from 20 years ago, you know, like the stuff that the left seemed to care about, now the right cares about. So do you think we'd be in a better place now if Trump had, whether or not he actually lost, if he were president now, do you think we'd be living in a better country? Or do you kind of agree that now that we have a dissident right, we're in a little bit more hopeful of a place?
I've never been more optimistic. I think things are worse now than they would have been if Trump had won. But there's a lot of stuff. Like, I mean, it wouldn't have solved anything, right? Trump wasn't going to make America great again. There's no political success to this. Right. That comes from just electing one person. Maybe Ron DeSantis, but. But yeah, that's not where the solution lies. The solution lies in a great awakening of the American people, recognizing that the American empire does not represent them as illegitimate and evil. And nothing has done more to forward that agenda than the last 12 months.
Right.
And in particular, the way Trump left, like that's why, like again, you know, if, complain about the spending and all those policies. But if you don't appreciate what Trump did, leaving the White House and burning the fucker down by going after the election issue, like that is the best thing that's ever happened. The lack of legitimacy in the federal institutions is through the roof. And I guess this is the key insight of Anatomy in the State and Rothbard, right? Is that the state's power does not lie in its weaponry. It lies in the perception of legitimacy of the people, which is why they penalize crimes that are subversive to legitimacy more than anything else. We're seeing that played out with QAnon or Q Shaman getting 4 years, whatever that is, right?
Right.
This is the moment. And you're absolutely right. Like, I mean, the GOP has become radicalized. And so the question then is, how do they not blow it? Because they've blown it in the past, you know, and the expectation should be for them to blow it. The expectation that we should all have is very cynical.
Expectation, so.
Yeah. And we should have no hope otherwise.
Yeah.
But that means that, so the way that I kind of do this is I try to identify, okay, well, when things happen that are not normal, then you don't get your hopes up, but you mark it because it's when we're breaking the historical norm, breaking the political norm, that's what opens the door to real change happening. And so, for example, what I would like to see, there's two things that I would measure whether the DC GOP, which is the worst GOP out there, and that includes some really bad states, the two ways that I would measure the GOP nationally getting something closer to what I want is number one, Speaker Kevin McCarthy not being Speaker of the House, and number two, Republicans across the country running on jailing Fauci.
Yep.
And I think it's probably right, Rand Paul is kind of starting that now. I think that's going to be a common drum, and so those are the two things I want to see happen between now and then. Then the next measurement will be whether they actually go after Fauci, because if you get a GOP that can that actually seriously investigates and gets, you know, if we get to Fauci behind bars, then we're throwing a party. But like even just getting serious about it and having a large percentage of that caucus serious about that issue, that is a different GOP. And again, you know, I'm not expecting these good things to happen. I'm not even saying we need to have, again, full on criminal charges to get us closer to where we need to be. But that's what we need to see from the GOP. And so what I'm excited about is, you know, I'm looking out there and I'm seeing it happen. You know, I'm seeing Blake Masters, you know, promote himself. You know, I think he's one of the best Senate candidates we've ever had. This is a guy that read Ludwig von Mises in high school, and I think is tonally just great. We've got Anthony Sabatini out there, who, you know, is I think one of the best at combining Trump rhetoric with substantive libertarian policy. That's that sort of stuff that I want to see. And you know, if those sort of people are successful, if that caucus of the, you know, shitting on Liz Cheney as an identity sort of thing, if that caucus keeps getting bigger, then that's what we would want to see if there's any hope of making the GOP anything beyond controlled opposition. And the exciting thing is beyond that is now you have all of this experimentation going on at the state level where it's like a race between governors to see, you know, who can, you know, have the biggest, you know, Let's Go Brandon, you know, piece of legislation out there. One man, I think, is winning in that race, but everyone's trying to do it. And that then, you know, if DC GOP could always be crap, if you simply got a nation of DeSantis type governors around, then we don't even need the national GOP. And so I think that there's reasons for like genuine optimism between what we're seeing happen and seeing the base support. And that's what gives me optimism, because ultimately it's the quality of the Republican base that matters in the long run more than the quality of the actual elected officials right now.
Sure. So we got into it over a tweet I put out. I'm going to try to share it on the screen here. I'm going to see if I can do this with my extremely limited technology skills. There we go. I think we got it there. All right. So I put this one out and we got into it a little bit. What I wanted to ask you. So first of all, with this, I mean, my demeanor on Twitter is always snarky and always sarcastic. What I'm really trying to get at here is it's not so much mocking Trump supporters. It's just getting them to realize that the problem isn't what they think it is. Like the problem is systemic. It's both Trump and Biden. The biggest thing being inflation right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, we printed off, I think, 35% of US dollars in history last year. So I really care about telling them the truth, even if it's uncomfortable, and saying like, look, you know, things aren't the Keystone Pipeline is not why we're having massive inflation. That's not the driving force. And last year, actually, just about a year ago, when the COVID relief bill went through, I had my channel, wasn't nearly as big as I am now, but I was covering that COVID relief bill and what was in it. And then Trump stood up to it and said, no, this is bullshit. You need to take all the pork out of it, and we're going to send $2,000 to every family. And I was cheering him on. I was like, yep, this is exactly what needs to happen. And most of my audience, which was Trump supporters, and most of my friends and family who saw it, who were mostly Trump supporters, when they were walked through what happened with the bill and then mm-hmm. Trump saying, no, don't do this. Fuck you. You know, take all this crap out and then I'll sign it. And then seeing him cave and end up signing it, that was really healthy for them. You know, they were like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know, their eyes were kind of open to what was going on, and some of my friends have completely become libertarians, and that was the turning point for them mm-hmm. when they saw that happen. So I felt like the disagreement you and I were having was like how blunt you're supposed to be with these people, because I agree with you. We shouldn't be turning them away. We shouldn't be just scoffing at them, calling them idiots all the time. But at the same time, you got to be like, look, you know, this is why this is happening. And, you know, I think that's, you know, that's really effective. So I just wanted to hear your thoughts on video on that.
Okay. I think we should never lie to people. And I think that, you know, or I was trying to identify here's the different ways that I would frame it from a paleo-libertarian perspective, which is kind of starting from the perspective that, yeah, the bastards did this and they should pay. And here's the way to protect yourself. And things, look, there's people that want to actually understand how a lot of this stuff works. I'm just not I don't think most people do. And that's fine. Like, I think that there's a way, I think the beauty of the paleo-libertarian approach is that it's a way of packaging libertarian ideas to people that don't want to have to eat their vegetables. And that's what makes it useful, because ultimately, you know, this is kind of the Ludwig von Mises sort of insight, right? Is that, you know, he talked about how, you know, one of the complaints that you get about capitalism is that, oh, well, you know, ends up producing a bunch of crappy detective novels rather than great works. And it's like, oh, well, this is what the average man wants. And so, like, you know, what I think the paleo strategy is great at is taking Rothbard and Mises and all that sort of stuff and condensing it down into a message that resonates with the anger that your average person feels. And there's a lot of people that are angrier than they are intellectually curious.
Sure.
And so again, there is definitely a role for educating about, you know, all the leads up and, you know, talking about 1972 and FDR and the entire, you know, what has the government done to our money? Like, I support all of that. And I was kind of just using that tweet as a very vivid contrast between different types of messaging within that movement.
Sure.
Because the thing is that I think there is this habit amongst some libertarians, you know, they think political discourse is proving that they are the one that's right and the other people are wrong. And honestly, persuasion matters more than simply being right. And sure. There's that psychological thing. And so that's something where I think a lot of libertarians are often bad at. And what I have fun with is trying to highlight how, you know, even something like inflation, you know, there's a culture war dynamic there that I think we would benefit from leaning into in order to kind of maximizing the sort of impact we can have and getting people, you know, organizing behind us and kind of trusting us to lead.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I've gotten into it with the type of libertarians you're talking about who only care about being autistic and correct. And a lot of them, you know, it's weird with the right, because I don't, there are some libertarians who think the left is closer to us, but for the most part, like, I mean, the right is viewed as the fellow traveler or the one who's closer to our belief system. So I think that's why you inherently have more tension there, because the imposter or the one who pretends to be more like you, those are the ones you have to watch out for more. Right. Certainly how Jimmy Dore, you know, he goes after the Democrats way more than the Republicans, mm-hmm. even though he's much closer to the Democrats than he is to what the Republicans claim to believe. I think that's just going to be a natural thing. So people take mm-hmm. that as though we somehow hate the right more than the left, or that we think the left is closer to our belief system, where I don't really think that's what it is. It's more like, no, it's just these people claim that they're basically the same as us when they're not. I think that's why you see that tension there.
Oh, absolutely. And this is why, like, you know, also people saying, oh, well, you know, good luck with your GOP strategy, but why do you feel it's important to go after the LP so much? And it's precisely this problem. It's because, you know, there's a finite amount of resources. And politics is a zero-sum game, and you can't do both. And so that tension's always going to lie when you're trying to reach the same sort of person. And, you know, that's kind of what makes some of this fun.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not convinced that the right has learned its lesson or that it's gotten a lot better. I think circumstantially they're better. I think they're utilitarian for certain purposes right now because they do feel so screwed over. But I think they have a very short-term memory, because I feel like lots of libertarians that bring up the Republicans of 20 years ago, and I can see how that's kind of unfair, but I'm talking about Republicans from last year, and I know it's been a crazy year, but in 2020, you know, the Republicans supposedly hated the CIA and didn't trust anything they said because of what they had just done to Trump with not Russiagate, but the one after Ukraine, you know, that whole, and Russiagate. But then when Trump airstrikes Soleimani and Mike Pompeo is giving a speech to Congress about why we had to get rid of this guy, suddenly the CIA is the most trustworthy source you've ever heard of. And I'm not just talking about like Marco Rubio and people in office. I'm talking about my Republican friends that I really know. Like, they were ready to fucking bomb Iran off the map and, you know, no holds barred. And then last year when I was arguing with them about stimulus, when Trump was passing it or the Republicans were supporting it as well, it was like talking to a brick wall. So, I mean, right now they are severely fucked over and they feel damaged because they lost big time and they don't own any of the culture war anymore. Like, that pretty much all the institutions are run by the left. So they seem really great. And I think we should use them you know, where we can. But I think some people just feel like, you know, oh, they've learned their lesson. They're not going to do any of the stupid shit again. I'm not hearing that from you in this conversation. Like you even explicitly said, we should expect them to fail again and we should hold them accountable. But I just think a lot of people are too forgiving, kind of like with the left wing after George Bush was president. You know, once they took power again, they were absolutely horrible. So I just worry about people kind of losing sight of that and acting like, you know, just because of the circumstances we're in now, that everything is fine. Like I'm expecting a red wave next year. I think I don't personally think the election was stolen last year. I think there was fraud and I think it was rigged in a lot of ways through the media and everything. I don't really buy that it was stolen, but I think 2022, you're going to see a red wave in Congress and the Senate. And then I think a Republican president is pretty much a given in 2024. And I don't think anything is going to get better. You're going to forget everything that's just happened. And we're just going to continue growing the government, spending, you know, staying at war. I don't know. I'm just not optimistic.
Well, some of the reasons that give me optimism, again, it would not surprise me at all if that is what plays out. That should be expected until it doesn't. Well, what gives me optimism is I think that there's a lot of, I think that the institutions on the right have changed. You know, Heritage Foundation isn't going anywhere, but you know, there's a lot of new blood within it. The people change, some of the ideas change, the intellectual influences change. And to that degree, I think the purging of the neocons, you know, every time a neocon disassociates itself from Fox News, the Republican Party, or whatever, like that only makes this entire, that only increases the odds that maybe they really will learn their own, right? And I think that to me is really where the battle lies, is improving the intellectual climate of the right in a way of, again, I'm not expecting them to be Rothbardians, you know, that'd be wonderful, but I'm not expecting that. But I think that we have to recognize that the Republican Party that we grew up in, like that Bush era Republican Party, was uniquely evil. And it was uniquely bad. And it was much worse than the, like, again, there were plenty of problems with the Reagan years. Like, I'm not trying to defend Reagan, definitely not from the Mises Institute, but like that, you know, the 2000s GOP was uniquely horrible. And it's great to see so many of those people flee. And so I think that what gives me hope is that if the ideological foundations of what influences policy on the right changes, then that is going to have the ability to have lasting income outcomes with the election. And again, that's where having some measurements are important to try to check your where you're at. The problem is, and this is the other kind of side here, is that there are some thinkers within this sort of new populist era that have ideas that are far worse than a lot of traditional conservatives on economic issues, on other stuff. And I think that is itself kind of a very interesting battle. And that is, again, why I think it's so important for people who, you know, are fans of Murray Rothbard and Ludwig von Mises and the Austrian tradition. You know, there is an important aspect of the division of labor here where we don't need all, but we need a good group of Austrian influenced individuals to be having those conversations within the right, to be having an impact on that congressional staffer that ends up having a lot of you know, discretion on things, you know, influencing that employee at a government agency that can do things here and there in the right direction, you know, improving the intellectual ability, you know, class of the right is going to be the best way of making sure that any of these elections mean a damn, no matter what. And again, there's some reasons that I have hope there, but again, we trust but verify, you know, and again, fully expecting that there's a full possibility that the right could become even worse on so many issues. That's where and the beauty of it, I think the inflationary issue is such a huge opportunity for us because, you know, basically when you're in an inflationary age, 95% of all political commentary ever written about economic policy goes out the window because it all is dependent upon spending more. And that's much harder to do if you're now dealing with a monetary crisis. And that, again, that's where we can really strike.
Yeah, so my life in 2021 has been better than it was in 2020, regardless of who the president is. My life has been better under Biden because my state has decided to, you know, give the middle finger to the mandates. Not that it mattered anyway. They ended up getting thrown out. But how do we hijack this populist movement to get people to care about their local communities? I mean, we're seeing some of it with school boards and things like that, but for the most part, people only pay attention to politics every 4 years when someone runs for president. I mean, they might vote in the midterm elections, but they don't have any idea who anyone is. They just go, they don't vote in the primaries. They just go in and vote straight ticket, whatever party they're in. So how do we get them to start caring about localism? And the way that I've done that, I feel like the betrayal of Trump has been what's red pilled most of my, and I mean like Trump betraying his base, not like people stabbing Trump in the back. I think Trump betraying his base has been the biggest success I've had at getting people to realize that localism is what matters. Mostly with that bill. That was like the big place I really hit it with a lot of people. So do you, like, how do you get people to care about what's going on in their community instead of at the federal level, or both at least?
Well, and I think this is an area where libertarians can are uniquely positioned to do. And the answer is you start paying attention to local politics yourself and being content creators, right? If you take your camera phone and you start going to your city council meetings, and then you come back and you do a video breaking down what has gone on, and you start diving into the connections between, you know, what politicians on the city council got money from these contractors and are now getting all these bids, right? You know, you're highlighting all the corruption and the cronyism and the abuses of the state and all this sort of stuff that we as libertarians are really good at. If you simply take that and start doing it from an original analysis standpoint in your community, and you start pumping that out there with, you know, on Facebook, on, you know, Twitter is not usually great for local stuff, but whatever. Facebook used to be, and unfortunately, and that's Facebook's kind of killing itself. But I think that's an area where libertarians are really good at content creation and really good at analyzing all the things the state does wrong. If we started focusing on creating content for our neighbors rather than for Liberty Twitter, I think that's a way of doing this in praxis. And I have a buddy here in Panama City that's been doing this for years, and he's been able to make a good following. He makes enough money from donations that he has a standalone office. You know, he does all sorts of stuff. I think that's a model that can be replicated in just about any small town in the country, and I think that's one of those ways where you can kind of really highlight the city council side of things. Politically, if you what I can do with my Republican Party is use the Republican brand to get endorsements done to try to punish. You know, we've got a Panama City Beach here is the only city in Bay County that ever had a mask mandate. Do you think I'm going to use the Republican Party to go after the bastards that did that? Yes, I am. And I have the ability to do that now. And I can use the brand of the Republican Party to attack them in nonpartisan races. And that's going to make a big difference in a +43 Republican county. And so that's a twofold part. One doesn't require you being a Republican. One doesn't require any sort of party thing at all. It is just you deciding to create content that is informative to your community. There's also, if you do history stuff too, that's an easy way of starting to get credibility. You spend 6 hours at the library, you'll know more about your town's history than 99% of the population. And if you start, you just share old photos and explain why they're neat. Again, it's an easy way of creating localized content. And again, requires no party to do. If you want to do the party route, you can get involved in your GOP and then use it as a sort of vengeance against all the bastards that betrayed the population last year.
So something interesting I heard you say is that you are also in favor of people using the Democrat Party if it makes more sense in their community. Do you want to just expound on that a little bit?
Sure. I am less confident about gains being made, to be perfectly honest. My suggestion, if you're in a deep blue area, is to move. But that's not possible for everyone. And I've talked to, you know, there's a guy at Mises U last year who lives in San Francisco. And so we were talking. And my recommendation for them is we should never forget that the great thing about Austrian economics is that it actually tells us something about the world. We have a better understanding of how the world works because we have a foundation in Austrian economics and we should use it. And so if you're a Democrat and if you're a libertarian and you're in a Democrat stronghold and you're really interested in politics and you want to go down that sadistic path, fine. Then, you know, be the non-crazy Democrat. You know, take, you know, fight for all the social issues you want and be the most lefty on the social issues from a libertarian perspective and do all of that, but then simply keep highlighting, no, like, you know, there's going to be consequences. This, you know, start getting your predictions on record, because that way, when the Democrats get eroded out and they just keep turning in each other and et cetera, if you're the guy in the room that knows what's going on and everyone else is just throwing shit at each other, you're going to stand up. Your social capital is going to rise. And so be the lefty on the social issues, take that libertarian out there, and then just don't be crazy in economic stuff. Be the smartest man in the room on the economic stuff. I don't think it's going to pay out in 2022. I don't think it's going to pay out in 2024. But again, if you want to go down that path, I think that's the best way of going forward. And again, I think even that, if you're interested in attending meetings and doing all that boring stuff, that slow payoff has a better chance of succeeding than, you know, going the LP route. But hey, if people want to go out and try to make the LP a culturally left party and make it a left-wing takeover, I'm okay with that too, because then that just helps on the edges when election time comes around. But I think most people don't want to do that. I think if you really want to do politics, that's the way I play it in a blue stronghold.
Yeah. So if, let's say, there's a red wave next year and then Republican presidential victory in 2024, and they just end up being absolutely horrible, what's the play from there? Like, just keep trying to influence from the Republican Party, or then does it actually make sense to switch over to the Democrat Party, or does that actually give an opening for the Libertarian Party? Let's say, I don't know, let's just say Rick Santorum, or even I'll use your man. Let's say Ron DeSantis ends up being president, but he ends up being, you know, a very Zionist neocon who would have made a much better governor, and then the entire Republican Congress that's in there doesn't care about spending, doesn't care about foreign policy. What's the play then? What do we do?
Move to Peru. You know, if that is the outcome, again, if Ron DeSantis comes in and it's Bush 2.0, we're screwed. I mean, I don't. Then there is no political hope. I think something short of that, though, to me, what matters is following the base. You know, what gives me hope is not Trump, it's the Trumpers. Mm-hmm. And so you know, it matters to me. Like, so depending on how they respond, if you know, they end up going back to being Bill O'Reilly Republicans rather than Tucker Carlson Republicans, then this political approach isn't going to work. The only thing that makes this work is the radicalization of middle America. And should that change, then that is when you reconsider political strategies and figure out, you know, what a new outcome is. I don't think the LP is a viable outcome in any of these things, just going back to the two-party aspect. You know, if something happens and there's something that completely implodes the party system, then we can reevaluate things, go there. Maybe there's a path. Like, say, for example, you have Republicans do great, taking it, you know, Trump voters put Republicans in office, the Republican Party doesn't change from a leadership perspective. The divide between your average voter and Republicans in Congress doesn't go down at all. Kevin McCarthy's still speaker, and you have neocons in every position, and they kick out, you know, all the interesting Republicans. Then I think there you could have a very interesting case for something more of the kind of Ross Perot route, where he was trying to flank the right from the right. And trying to start a third party, maybe that is the better outcome at that point. The problem there is that Trump is, you know, there's so many Republicans that have done such a good job of sucking up to Trump, and he, you know, that's one of his you know, is what it is. He's not a useful icon in kind of creating that opposition party. But I think ultimately that would, you know, that might be the play there. But ultimately, if this doesn't work, you know, I was already in a, hey, there's no way of politically saving America. We need to try to be identifying, you know, somewhere else to go. COVID's kind of changed that, because I really don't know where else to go. There is to go anymore. Right. But it's only because of what Trump voters did in 2015, 2016, that I had any sort of delusions about any sort of political success in that. And so should that moment die the same way the 90s died with 9/11, politically 90s, then, you know, maybe there is no hope there. And I'm willing to accept that is a very real possibility.
Yeah. My biggest fear is that the lesson, instead of being learned, instead of like realizing, holy shit, all this power that we sort of created 20 years ago is being used against us and we need to make blockades. I think they've done some of that, but I feel like the biggest impulse is for revenge. So if they take over, I just foresee more power being seized, more laws being passed against the opposition, and then kind of just entering another stage of this cycle. Like, I think, you know, a lot of people are really worried about this left-wing woke culture, and it sucks. I hate it too. But I actually think they've overplayed their hand and things are going to swing the opposite way culturally eventually, because people like Bill Maher have had enough. You know, they used to be the kind of progressive leaders 20 years ago culturally, you know, about like, hey, we need to start accepting people and we need to be more tolerant. And now they're like, what the fuck is this? This has gotten so nuts. So I actually see things swinging in, like, I mean, we're already a fascist country, but in a more fascistic, like right-wing cultural way in the next decade. I could be wrong about that, but I'm really worried about that happening too. I don't think that's the worry right now, but I think it's an imminent concern. What do you think about that?
I understand where you're coming from. I don't have those concerns, mainly for two reasons. One, I am taking notice of kind of more pivot there, and I think it's interesting. I think it definitely opens up a window for perhaps some course correction, and I think there's a lot of Republican or a lot of Democrats in D.C. that would love to do nothing more than kind of move on. I don't think it's going to happen though, and because I think that the woke left is a minority of the left, and it's right. The most toxic part of the left. But what they are overrepresented in is the activist base that goes and knocks on doors. And that's a very important base to have. And so you kind of have to keep those troops going. And the other side of it is that there's certain choke points that progressive activists have been very good at. For example, you know, there's the way that consulting is done on doing analysis about corporations and the way that kind of left activists have used kind of activism within financial markets to kind of, you know, keep CEOs that, you know, are on paper like 60-40 Republican completely quiet on any political issue, because, you know, if they say one thing, they can then be attacked by these people that you know, influence how pension funds are invested in and all that sort of thing. So there's the institutions, I think the woke are the minority, but they have outsized influence in influential institutions. And so until that power dynamic change, like their power in this country doesn't come from elections as much as it comes from the investment they've made in their long march. And until that changes, I'm not too worried. What I am interested in is to see what degree you see Republicans get serious about that. Like, I mean, one of the things that I think is very possible, would this be one of those changes in political norms that I think are interesting and would tell me the GOP is in the right perspective, is I think you could start seeing Republicans championing purging state-funded universities of Marxists and things like that. And like, I would support that because we already have a very politicized process of how these, you know, university jobs are allocated. You talk to a George Mason grad and they're having a very difficult time getting, you know, in the job market because there's so much discrimination against anything that reeks of Coke money or, you know, libertarianism or whatever. I think you could start seeing some advancement within that at the state level, but even that is just starting to play at that institutional game that the left had so much success with for decades. And, you know, that would be just, again, a sign of times changing just a little bit.
All right, man. Well, I told you an hour. We're coming up on an hour. I would love to have you back on again. Sure. I really like the way you think. I like talking with you. I like battling with you on Twitter. I'm sure we'll keep that up in the meantime.
I hope so.
But I've got your Twitter page linked in the description. Is there anywhere else you want people to follow you, keep up with you? Just drop your plugs now.
Yeah. I've been doing a podcast, Redneck Riviera, with my buddy Ford Seuss. Kind of a little taste of life down here and our little take of things. And if anyone in your audience wants a copy of Economics in One Lesson, the Mises Institute still has some free copies that they're giving away. You can do that at Mises.org/one lesson. We pay for shipping and the like. Hey, makes for an easy Christmas gift too that you don't have to pay for. So play that whatever way you want, but that's going on at Mises.org.
All right, very good. Everyone check in tomorrow night at 9:00 p.m. Eastern time. I will be on with Dave Smith. And then on Saturday, if you're in Utah at 6 o'clock, I forget what the name of the event center is, but Adam Kokesh is coming here and we're throwing, I think it's the 100th anniversary of the Libertarian Party of Utah. I will be there. I don't know if anyone in my audience watching now is in Utah, but if you are, you can see me there. But thanks though. This was great. We'll do it again.
Sounds good. And if you're ever down this way, free beer here in Panama City.
All right. I'll-